Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. Today we are going to revisit our conversation from May with Norwegian explorer Erling Kagge. We're going to be talking about his travels and his book, Silence in the Age of Noise. Then later in this hour, we'll talk with Vicky Varela, Managing Director of the Utah Office of Tourism. We'll talk about trends in tourism to Utah and how Utah tourism officials are adjusting their marketing to try to help those communities who feel like they're being loved to death, among other topics. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour today is explorer, art collector, publisher, and author Erling Kagge. He's the first person to have completed on foot the Three Poles Challenge, the North Pole, the South Pole, and the summit of Mount Everest. He's written six books on exploration, philosophy, and art collecting. He runs Kagge Forlag, a publishing company based in Oslo, where he lives. We're going to talk about a couple of his books. The latest is Walking One Step at a Time. Another is Silence in the Age of Noise. In that book, Mr. Kagge shows us why silence is essential to our sanity and happiness, how it can open doors to wonder and gratitude. Erling Kagge joins us from his home, I guess. Are you in Oslo, Mr. Kagge?
Yes.
We appreciate you joining us. Good morning. Yeah. Good afternoon where you are, I guess.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I wanted to start, before we jump into your books, fascinating books, wonderful. You have completed the three-pole challenge, North Pole, South Pole, and summit of Mount Everest. We're hearing reports this year of a higher than usual number of deaths on Mount Everest. I wonder what your perspective is on that. It's just extremely crowded up there, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, first of all, you feel with sadness because so far 11 people have died. But also, you know, having seen that photo of the last part up to the summit, there's a long line, long queue to get to the summit. It's also sad because that's not how it should be on the mountain. But yeah, so you know, it's not a great time for mountaineering. That's for sure.
Yeah, tell us about your experience up there. What did you experience?
I did this 25 years ago, summited Everest, and then it was much less people. So you know, it was easier because we were maybe 30 or 40 permits that year, but this year I think it's almost 400. So it was much less crowded, and you know, which you know was very nice for me because it made it easier to get to the summit. So, but you know, we humans, we are kind of born explorers. So you know, it's kind of something deep inside us that we like, you know, to summit the highest mountain in the world. So that challenge will remain, and people keep on doing it.
That impulse seems to be very strong in you, obviously. Tell us about that. What your impulse to, you write in your book, Silence, whenever I'm unable to walk, climb, or sail away from the world, I've learned to shut it out. So that impulse to walk, climb, or sail away from the world.
Yeah, you know, it's as you mentioned, that I once walked alone to the South Pole and for 50 days and nights under the midnight sun. And that taught me a great lesson on silence, because I didn't have any radio contact. And when I started out, I felt kind of everything was white and everything was flat all the way out to the horizon. But as the days and weeks passed by, I start to see all these variations in the snow, that it was not, you know, it had a bit bluish, yellowish, greenish appearing, and it wasn't totally white either. And I started to communicate with the environment, like sending some ideas out and getting some other thoughts back again, because the silence can speak to you. And eventually I was wondering if Antarctica was changing, but of course it was me who was changing and kind of getting more and more a part of nature. And that again, you know, taught me how important silence can be, and that we all need silence.
I read that you, the company that transported you to this part of Antarctica required that you have a radio, but you took the batteries out.
Yeah, that was not so nice to the company, maybe, but my goal was to walk in total solitude to the South Pole to experience this total silence. And when the airplane company forced me to bring a radio, I took the radio, but I left the batteries in the trash bin on the airplane. So when I started out, I had a radio, but no way to use it.
In your book, this is the beginning of the book, you said, only when I understood that I had a primal need for silence was I able to begin my search for it. A primal need for silence. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, all we humans, we have a need for silence. And I think we always had a hard time dealing with silence. Like for humans to be in a silent room for a longer time is, you know, kind of feels complicated. And of course, today when we have so many temptations with the smartphones and different devices, we're always searching for noise. And I think, you know, once in a while, we need silence to relax. We need silence to discover ourselves. And we need silence to develop our minds. So if you always go for noise, life feels shorter and life feels much poorer.
In today's world, you know, if you're not going to Antarctica, if you're in the city, can you find silence?
Yes. I think, you know, somehow, of course, if you're in a busy city in Utah or in Norway, you can't wait for the silence to come to you. So you actually have to search for your own silence, kind of invent your own silence, find your own silence, and to shut out the world. And I'm doing that myself by walking a lot. And I walk the stairs, I try to walk to the metro, and the silence I'm searching for is a silence which is within, because, you know, in a city it will be so much sounds around you, but still you have this silence within, which I think it's very important to listen to, because that silence speaks to you, and you should be aware of that.
You quote the philosopher Pascal. Inward exploration can be, it makes people nervous, makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's interesting because this French philosopher Pascal wrote in the 1640s that all humanity's problems stems from one single thing, and that's our inability to sit in a room alone doing nothing. And instead of doing nothing, we start to do something, and that's the beginning of all of the problems. And I think that's, you know, that's a very interesting point, and it was sure relevant 350 years ago, but it's 370 years ago, but it's still, you know, more relevant today.
So this, we talked about you took the batteries out of the radio. You definitely wanted that solitude. What about, you know, I don't think you're a Luddite, are you, in your regular life? You use technology, but how do you get away from that to find that silence?
You know, as I said, I think it's important to use technology. I think, you know, it's many advantages with technology, but sometimes you need to have a break because all those apps, of course, Facebook, Instagram, Snap, etc., were, you know, originally made to make people happy and make people, you know, get in touch with each other. But today we see that we have an increasing level of sadness, loneliness, and also with the depressions. So I think this is part of due to overuse of technology. So sometimes you need a break. And I think that's quite also easy to do. Like, you know, when I'm here in Oslo, I see people, when you walk the streets, you're always holding a telephone in your hand. And you're checking the news maybe three times in an hour, although, you know, nothing has happened. And that's a habit we actually have to get rid of because it makes our life, you know, much more complicated.
You quote Pascal, many philosophers in this book, you also quote the writer David Foster Wallace. I want to read this. He says, "Bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude at the gift of being alive, conscious, lies on the other side of crushing boredom." He says, pay close attention to the most tedious thing you can find, tax returns, televised golf, and in waves, boredom like you've never known will wash over you and just about kill you. But he's suggesting that we actually do seek this out.
Yeah, I like that quote very much. I even remember when I was a kid, I complained to my mother that I was bored. And, of course, I was bored because nothing was happening and I didn't have anyone to play with. My mother said to me every time, Erling, it's healthy to be bored every now and then. I didn't understand what she meant, but today I do. And I think, you know, sometimes we need to accept that we can't be satisfied at all times, that sometimes life is a little bit boring and it should be a little bit boring. I think my mother was right.
Did you find that in your kids as well?
That's a difficult one because, you know, I think my kids, as many people today, they still feel boredom. But while, you know, our generation, we were bored because we didn't have anything to do. I think, you know, now people are bored of the opposite reason, because it's too many options, it's too many things to do, too many apps, too many TV series, too much going on. So it's kind of an overflow of things to do, and that makes people bored. This kind of paradox of choice makes people bored.
David Foster Wallace said we should get to a state that he called unborable.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a very interesting idea. Unfortunately, he eventually committed suicide, and it is claimed that he actually committed suicide out of boredom.
Yeah, that's,
so that's also kind of a sad story, but I think, you know, he was an unbelievable good writer.
What does that say about his philosophy, do you think, that he did commit suicide?
You know, I think that's hard to say because I didn't know him. I only know him as an author, and, you know, that kind of choices or that kind of actions always have, you know, so many, you know, such a complicated background, so I think it's hard to speculate too much.
It's probably true. There are a lot of complicating factors. I wonder, before we go to break, I want to ask you that you asked three profound questions in the book. What is silence? Where can it be found? And why is it now more important than ever? We've been hitting a little bit on those. I want to dive into those. I was fascinated. Many examples in the book. You talk about a performance artist named Marina Abramović, she did a piece in the Museum of Modern Art, where I guess she just sat and stared at the audience.
Yeah, it was for, you know, not only for days but for weeks, sitting there facing people in coming and going in silence. And I think, you know, what's interesting about, you know, Marina Abramović is this story she tells about searching for silence. She was dreaming about visiting a desert, sitting in the middle of the desert with no sounds around her, and then experience a total silence. But what happened was that she eventually got to the desert. It was quiet. She sat down, but then she had all this noise in her head. And she was thinking too much. And, you know, if you're thinking about the past, you're thinking about the future. So she didn't find silence right away. But slowly all those thoughts disappeared. And she started to experience the environment and experience the silence. And then, you know, then she became content.
That must have been quite the experience. And you write that she reported that after a long time, she could distinguish sounds outside the building with more and more precision.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, interesting thing, like, you know, this experience in this performance piece at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, as she said that, you know, when she started out, she only heard the noise from the people walking back and forth to see her into the eyes. But eventually, she started to hear more and more. And that's the interesting thing with silence, that it kind of, you know, it makes us so much more aware of what's going on and so much more aware of what you kind of also going on inside your head. So eventually she started to hear the noises out on the street. And I find that very, very interesting, because I think in a noise, when you live in noise, somehow you hardly hear anything.
And I think she reported that this experience was a positive experience for her. But she said she was unsettled when she went to the desert.
Yeah, exactly, because you know, it's not enough to have silence around you. You actually need to calm down. And I think that's a big struggle we have in today's world, because, you know, we always want to be available. We always want to be connected. And that, again, is a kind of noise. And, you know, all these distractions, they're kind of noise. So it's not enough to get to a totally quiet place. You actually also have to, you know, find peace within yourself. And I think that peace, you know, and that silence is the most important of them all.
Young people, it's reported the young people today have a fear of being left out, right? They always want to be connected because they feel like their friends will be doing something and they'll be left out. So harder maybe for them to disconnect?
Yeah, but, you know, I think this fear of missing out is FOMO. I think, you know, that's not only young people. I think that's kind of, you know, that's almost all generations now, that kind of fear of missing out, and they would like to be available. And, you know, an average Norwegian any age will watch the screen on the phone for 4 hours every day, and they will probably touch the phone 2,600 times every day. And morally, it's nothing wrong with it, but, you know, it's a matter about wasting your life.
Yeah, good point. I've never made a study of how much I look at my phone or touch my phone. I imagine I would be distressed to learn how much.
Yeah.
I do.
You know, the interesting is, if you spend 4 hours every day on your phone and you live for 8 years, that's about 30,000 days. So that's, again, 120,000 hours of your lifetime, you know, watching or looking down onto your phone.
Yeah,
and you know, that's lots of waste of time.
By the way, you talked to this performance artist Abramovich, and this is for the English version of the book, because the version Norway had come out. This was interesting. So the best way to describe silence would be to put a blank sheet of A4 paper in a Xerox machine, then hold the original and the copy next to each other. She says that is silence.
But, you know, she's an artist. I'm not. But I think it's well said, because, you know, somehow in one way, silence is white. It's hardly anything. Or kind of, you know, as my kids said, silence is nothing, and nothing comes from nothing. But, you know, it's also partly wrong, because silence is not nothing. Silence is at least something.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, more with Erling Kagge. He is an explorer, author, publisher. He is the first person to complete on foot the Three Poles Challenge, the North Pole, South Pole, and the summit of Everest. And his books include Silence in the Age of Noise. We're talking about that. We'll get into talking about walking one step at a time. That's the latest book from Erling Kagge. We've reached him in Oslo, Norway, and more following this break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members. And Cash Arts 2019 through 2020 National Touring Season presents The Illusionists and Black Violin. Ticket and seating information at casharts.org.
Democrats say President Trump abused his power when he asked for a probe into a political rival. Now key players involved in the Ukraine affair will offer public testimony for all of America to hear.
The president is not above the law.
They've got nothing. All they have is a phone call that was perfect.
Join NPR for special coverage of the public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into the president from NPR News.
Wednesday evening starting at 6 p.m. on Utah Public Radio.
Find full video of the impeachment hearings on our website, upr.org.
This is John Meyer with the Utah Climate Center. This week's UPR and AP series, What Can Be Saved, features China's parks. China wages an enormously ambitious plan to protect and restore natural habitats in one of the most densely populated places on Earth, building on the example of pioneers in the U.S. national park system. Follow the journey online only at upr.org.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. More to come with Erling Kagge. Norwegian explorer. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. I want to let you know that later in this hour, I'm going to be talking with Vicky Varela, Managing Director of Utah's Office of Tourism. We're going to be talking about communities who feel they're being loved to death, what Utah Office of Tourism is doing about that, trends in tourism. That conversation is coming up. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest is Erling Kaga. He is the first person to have completed on foot the Three Poles Challenge, North Pole, South Pole, and Summit of Mount Everest. He's author of several books, and we'll get into talking a little bit about his latest book, Walking, One Step at a Time. We're talking about his book, Silence in the Age of Noise, right now. And in the book, he answers, or at least explores the questions, what is silence, where can it be found, and why is it now more important than ever? I'd like to address those questions to you, maybe just to talk about them briefly. So what is silence? What is your answer to that?
In one way, it's kind of the opposite of sounds, but to me, it's much more. So I think about silence as the opposite to noise. And when I think about noise, I'm thinking about all the distractions we have in our daily lives, from our smartphones, from our different devices, and all the distractions, and of course also all the different sounds, all this together, that's noise to me. And then again, silence is the opposite of all this.
Before I ask the next question, I want to ask you again about your experiences. You write about the one in Antarctica. And it's just you out there, right? And so it's you yourself and you. but
yeah.
there's a whole vast world out there. The white turns into, it's not just a white. But I wonder about, you feel the blood circulating in your body, I imagine, right?
Yeah, it's somehow... I was expecting to find total silence in Antarctica. But to my surprise, total silence does probably not exist. Because even in Antarctica, when it was, no one speaking, no sounds from absolutely anything, I could still hear my heart beating. I could hear kind of my blood circulating. And even if I hold my breath,
it sounds like we have lost Mr. Kaga. Let's go to promotional announcements. We'll get him back on the phone. Erling Kaga, author of Silence in the Age of Noise and Walking One Step at a Time, Norwegian explorer. We've reached him in Norway. Let's go to a break and come back. Thanks for joining us. We got disconnected there. We apologize for that, Mr. Kaga. Erling Kaga, author of Silence in the Age of Noise and Walking One Step at a Time. You were talking about your experience out in Antarctica when we disconnected.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that although everything was quiet around me, I still had all these sounds inside me. I kind of hear the heart was beating. And my blood circulating, but I could still find the silence within. So I think that's the most important silence we have, and that's something I also kind of discovered walking to the South Pole: the importance of being in touch with the silence within.
What do you find in that silence within? A lot of people get nervous. Some people find terror in that silence within. You find very positive emotions.
Yeah, but sometimes even I can find terror, that I can find silence to be very uncomfortable. But when I want to write a book, I want to write about this kind of positive emotions you get off of silence. And I think, to me, first of all, in the silence, I meet myself. And of course, if you are religious, deeply religious, you'll find God. Because, for instance, in the Bible, but God doesn't come in a heavy storm or with lots of noise. God appears eventually when it becomes absolutely quiet. And you can find the same in different religions. So I think, but to me, that to me, it is about getting to know myself better. And of course, that can be uncomfortable. It can be a little struggle, but it's definitely worth it.
Mm. We've talked a bit about this. I wonder if you could expand on this. Your third question, why is it silence now more important than ever?
I think it's more important today than ever because there's so much more noise. So I think it has always been important in for every human, but today it's so much noise. So when I have three teenage daughters, so eventually I understood they didn't even know what silence is, because their life is all about noise, and because they had so much noise, my life also become kind of all about noise. And that was one of the reasons I sat down to write a book, because, I want my kids to slowly start to understand that noise is okay, but not all the time, that sometimes you need to search for your own silence.
And the second question, where can silence be found? I mean, you're saying that silence can be found, I guess, anywhere.
Yeah, I think it can be found anywhere. And, if you don't find it, you somehow have to invent it yourself. I think it's, to a great degree, a matter about attitude. And, I'm 56 years old now, so I'm starting to go to all the 60s, 70s, and 80th birthdays. And what people talk about on all those birthdays, one theme that is, is there all the time, is life is short. Everybody complains that life is short. But the thing is, life is long. Life is not short at all. But if you do the same things every day, for instance, living through your telephone, life will feel short. But that's a huge misunderstanding.
I want to, before we leave silence, talk about walking with some related themes here. I want to talk about urban exploration. You went out with a friend, an urban explorer. I didn't know there were such people. In New York City.
Certainly. I went out to this urban explorer, historian called Steve Duncan, an American. And we went to Northern Bronx, way up north on Broadway, went and went across New York City through its train, subway, water, and sewage tunnels. And we kept on for 5 days, sleeping on the ground, and from Bronx, went through the sewage from Bronx down to Harlem and crisscrossed the whole city. Just to see New York City from the inside out and what the city would look like if you turned it upside down.
So you went up over the bridge, on the top of the bridge, to be clear. You had to do it at night because the police wouldn't let you.
Had to do it at night.
Yeah.
Because it's so much, I don't know about Utah, but at least in New York, it's so much police. At least it feels like it when you are afraid of it. And it's not a big crime, but obviously nobody's going to give you permission to jump into manholes in the street to get into the sewage or climb the bridge. So you have to do it while it's dark, that's for sure.
You told of an experience. It was wonderful up there at that height to see the sunrise coming.
Exactly. So it's, I think, I was standing on top of Williamsburg Bridge, looking into Brooklyn and Queens, seeing the sun rising over the horizon. And, then you just feel this great feeling of gratefulness. I think that's a very important feeling, because I think that's kind of, it's so easy not to be grateful. But I think, everybody, when you wake up and you see the sun is rising, You should feel gratefulness.
Hmm. Now, I can understand that. Then you went into the sewers. And I don't know if gratitude is what you felt there, but tell us about that.
I didn't feel any gratitude in the sewers.
Okay, all right.
It's in Bronx, the sewage tunnels are quite wide and high, but while down in Soho, they were much more narrow. It probably sounds more crazy on the radar than it was, but, Steve and I eventually end up crawling through the sewage of Soho. And if you would like to hear, you know, kind of a dirty fun fact, you know, somehow the people in Soho use much more toilet paper than the people in Bronx.
That's an interesting sociological study that you can see underneath the city.
You know, people in Soho have much more money.
Right. The simple fact. But you can hear, if you're down there enough, you distinguish sounds. It seems to be a running pattern. You can distinguish sounds differently.
Yeah, you can. And of course, New York City is very much about making money. And to make money makes lots of noise. So it's very hard in New York to find any quiet places and silent places. But still, again, you know, you need to invent it, and you need, you know, probably need to find it within inside yourself. And even in way into the tunnels, you could still hear the sounds from a truck maybe hitting, passing over a manhole, or the subway passing, and then the nearby tunnel. So it's always noise in New York. You know, as I say in the song, it never sleeps.
I can't leave the book without treating this. This was very interesting to me. You said that you have learned one poem by heart, or at least a poem by heart, a haiku.
Yeah.
It's putting you on the spot. Do you remember it?
I remember it. It's a frog jumps into a dam. The sound of water. Almost it?
Yes. An old pond, a frog jumps in, the sound of water. Yes.
Yeah, I was not very impressive, but that's, in Japan you have this strong culture for silence. You can tell in this little haiku, but also if you listen to people, Japanese people, and watch them, you know, having a conversation, you can see that the silent moments between the words or between the sentences are just as important as the words. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I can see that as an old pond, and then the frog jumps in, sound of what the silence is between the lines. Then there's an even more impressive example. You quote a poem, a poet from the Matsushima group of islands. It's two words, O Matsushima. That's the entire poem.
Exactly, again and again. And I like that, because that's how we humans are, that you kind of can see something and then kind of remain with that impression. So kind of, you know, it's kind of repeated. And I think in the Western tradition, we don't appreciate that kind of emotion. So that's why I included that kind of strange poem. And I think, you know, it's in terms of silence, we have a little bit to learn from the East, I think.
Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about your newest book, Walking One Step at a Time. Here's just a portion. Placing one foot in front of the other, embarking on the journey of discovery, experiencing joy of exploration, these activities are intrinsic to our nature. We'll have more with Erling Kaga following this break.
Hey, comedian Craig Bielek here. You know what is bad? Going through life with regrets. You know, wow, why didn't I take that job? Why didn't I go to school? I never learned to work a VCR, and now it's way too late. One regret you're really going to have is if you don't support UPR by going to Comedy Night on Saturday, November 16th. You can get tickets at upr.org. My friend Josh and I will be there doing comedy. You're going to kick yourself in the morning if you're not there. You're going to regret this for years, and I don't want that to happen to you. I got your back. We'll see you there.
Asia is the Earth's largest continent, and on the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll hear some of its most intriguing voices. From the immense country of India to the Thai Peninsula and the island nations of Japan and Indonesia to the continent's largest country, China. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Voices of Asia, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to a conversation with a Norwegian explorer, Erling Kaga, recorded in May of this year. Coming up following the next segment, we'll have some time to talk with Vicky Varela, Managing Director of the Utah Office of Tourism. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We've reached our last segment with explorer, art collector, publisher, and author Erling Kauge. He's the first person to have completed on foot the Three Poles Challenge, the North Pole, the South Pole, and the summit of Mount Everest. The latest book is Walking One Step at a Time. We'll talk a bit about this in the segment of the program. And Mr. Kauge has joined us from Oslo. So Erling Kauge, the beginning of this book, you talk about kind of parallel events. Your grandmother, who can no longer walk, is dying, and your daughter, 13 months old, is learning to walk.
Yeah, that was a great, or at least a very interesting experience to me, because I was very fond of my grandmother, and she had been a very much a walking grandmother. She didn't have a car, so she kept on walking. And eventually she couldn't walk anymore. And, you know, she sat down and lay down and never got up again. And I just kind of felt that was the day she died. Obviously, she lived for a few more months, but, you know, it felt like she was dying. And at the same time, my second daughter, Solveig, she started to learn how to walk. She kind of got up onto two legs and walked across the sitting room, out through the door, into the garden, and started to wonder what was hidden behind the or beyond the horizon. And again, just want to have more and more space around herself. So that was, you know, strange feeling, like a grandchild and a father to another child, to see this. And that's also kind of taught me a lesson about how important it is to be able to walk.
You write, placing one foot in front of another, investigating and overcoming our intrinsic to our nature. Journeys of discovery are not something you start doing, but something you gradually stop doing. A lot of us do stop doing this sense of wonder and awe.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's because I think we're all born explorers in that sense. When people ask me, when did you start to explore? I think, you know, we all start to explore when we are, you know, only a few months old. Maybe when we're still in the stomachs of our mothers, we kind of are explorers. And I think that spirit never goes away, but obviously it's diminished, but it never goes away.
Obviously for you, you've kept this or want to keep rediscovering it. You've gone to, you know, South Pole, North Pole, Everest, various explorations. What is it about you and others who are out there exploring? What are you looking for?
You know, I think, you know, it's very much about curiosity, and it's very much about wonder being the kind of engine of life, and it's very much about experiencing nature and be connected to nature. I think one of the big mistakes we're doing today is that, you know, we're getting less and less connected to nature, that we kind of feel superior to nature. And so I think, you know, it's that kind of emotions, you know, and it's important also, you know, famously George Mallory said, why should you climb Mount Everest? And he said, because it's there. And that's a good answer, because I think, at least to me, it reminds me that it's very few things in life you actually have to do. And that's why also need to, I think, you know, you need to make life more difficult than necessary. And it's definitely, if you're born in Norway, probably if you're born in Utah too, that, you know, if you make these choices throughout the day and throughout your life, and if you always go for the easiest option in life, you'll become an unfree human being, and you will probably also become a quite dull human being. So you need to go for the most difficult choices, you know, more frequent, I think.
You said we can tend to feel superior to nature. How do we overcome that? Walking would be one when we get out and be a part of nature.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a big misunderstanding, and you know, now the whole thing now with, for instance, with climate change, that the world is heating up. You know, that's also a reminder that, you know, we can be strong, we have fantastic technology, make inventions. But somehow, the nature, you know, decides the big questions, And also thinking of our daily lives. If you're going to live a rich life, we need to be connected to nature, because, you know, what kind of nature tells us who we are, where we came from, and, you know, also a little bit, you know, what's going to happen in the future.
I love this part of the book. You said, how much further is it? Is one of the questions that I've asked most often. And this is young people often. your kids probably ask that.
I kept on asking my mother.
Yeah.
We're all skiing or hiking, you know, how far is it left? And when I got kids myself, that was the, you know, most frequently asked question in my family. And the second question usually was, why do we have to walk when it's faster to drive? I think that's a really good question, which is hard to, you know, come up with good answers. And that's part of why I wrote my book about walking, because I think it's important to not equal speed to progress. I think, you know, the whole education system, the government, business, is all about us speeding up. But I think, you know, once in a while, we need to slow down. We need to walk. We need to, you know, look after ourselves.
Before we run out of time, I want to have you talk about going to what's now known as Robinson Crusoe Island. Alexander Selkirk was the real-life inspiration for Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. The island's now been renamed, a good bit of tourism promotion. Tell me about that, your visit to Robinson Crusoe Island.
Yeah, because my father, he read Robinson Crusoe for me when I was a kid. And he always told me, you know, this is based on a true story. It has happened. And one day I sailed down the Pacific and I came to the island and started to, you know, follow in his footsteps and kind of found the cave and also found the lookout, you know, up in the mountains where he was walked up every day to look for a ship that could save him. And I think it took, you know, 4 years. And I like that it actually walked up every day. And, of course, it was disappointed every day until a ship appeared on the horizon. But I also think, you know, those walks with that hope also kept him alive.
So we're just about at the end of time. I know we have to let you go here soon. What's the takeaway? What do you hope people get from this book, Walking One Step at a Time?
I think it's important to keep in mind that many things, but I think, you know, obviously if you walk, you live longer than other people, you have lower blood pressure, you will become more creative, and your heart beats better, but that's only half the truth. And I want to write about the other half, how actually walking in a very simple way can enrich your life.
Wonderful. Erling Kagge is an explorer, art collector, publisher, and author. He is author most recently of Walking One Step at a Time, previous book Silence in the Age of Noise, and he's reached us from Oslo. Erling Kagge, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
I appreciate it. And we are glad you joined us for our repeat of that broadcast from May of this year. We have a bit of time, and here's an opportunity for us to hear from Vicky Varela, Managing Director of the Utah Office of Tourism. We'll talk about trends in tourism in Utah, including towns that feel they're being loved to death. This interview was recorded in September this year.
Utah's had a tourism marketing office for many years, but it really went into high gear in 2006 because the legislature established a tourism marketing performance fund. So we've been telling our state story ever since.
So what are the results? You said you really kicked it into high gear 2006. What are the numbers show? Worth the money the legislature kicked in?
Yes. I think everyone's been very pleased at the economic benefits of a tourism economy. This last year, tourists spent $13.4 billion. That generated $1.3 billion in state and local tax revenues. That's money that you and I don't have to spend, taxes that we don't have to pay that cover the cost of our schools and our police officers, local services. When you see a tourist, smile and say thank you.
There you go. So where do you advertise? All over the world? Where do you concentrate?
Yes, we have a domestic advertising campaign that focuses on the East and West Coast for our skiing marketing, and then surrounding states for our three-season marketing of winter. Or excuse me. We market to surrounding states for our spring, summer, fall. In addition to that, we do international marketing. We've done marketing in Europe for many years. The key countries are United Kingdom, Great Britain, Germany, France. They're all very interested in having the Utah experience. And then we also do marketing in China. Canada is a huge market for us. We've expanded into Australia and New Zealand, and we're just starting to do some marketing in India.
Hmm, interesting. Yeah, I was in Bryce Canyon this summer, and on the shuttle, I heard several different languages being spoken. That's not unusual.
Yes, our national parks are sort of like international airports.
Yeah.
You're every language.
Now, I was also in Moab this summer. I've been in, you know, the high of the season is pretty, it's pretty crowded, a lot of bustle. I've been in Zion, height of the season. Some of these areas, some of the locals are saying, boy, we're just being loved to death.
Yes, we actually are very mindful of that. And over the last several years, we have changed our marketing strategy dramatically. In 2017, we launched a business initiative called the Red Emerald Strategy. And the Red Emerald is really about expanding the places that we market for people to visit, encouraging people to get off the beaten path and have rich local experiences in communities that want and need to expand their tourism economies. The point of this is to reduce the impact for local communities, and to give our visitors a really high-quality experience. So we're not at all about increasing the volume of visitors. We're about increasing the quality of their experience, which then translates into the amount of money that they're willing to spend that brings revenues back into our local economies.
Are you seeing changes in patterns the visitors do? Are they going to different places based on the marketing that you're doing?
Yes. There's been a dramatic shift as we've shifted our marketing to focusing more on state parks and the places in between the national parks. Visitors have changed their travel patterns as well. So back in the years when we were doing aggressive Mighty Five marketing, we were experiencing double-digit growth at the national parks, and that was just more success than we needed. And so we shifted to focusing on state parks, other surrounding areas. We now have double-digit growth in visitation to the state parks, and we've reduced the growth in visitation to the national parks. It's in the very low-digit increases, like in the 4% range last year.
What about Utahns? Do you marketing there? Do you see people doing staycations?
Yes, Utahns, we love for Utahns to circulate within the state and experience the state. That's not part of our mission to market to our own citizens, but it's an important part of the quality of life that all of us expect, either having grown up here or having moved here for the great outdoor recreation. And we like to talk about the fact that Mother Nature played favorites. There are really is no place on earth where you have this variety of natural wonders.
What about the wintertime, the famous, the greatest snow on earth?
Is a huge, important part of our tourism economy. Mm-hmm. We had the highest spend, visitors had the highest spend last year that we've ever had. We had the best snow that we've had in decades. Beauty of ski tourists, Australians in particular, come and stay for a very long time, and they spend a lot of money while they're here. So that's a remarkable part of our tourism offerings. There's no place else on earth that you can drive 45 minutes from the airport to get to this grade of snow.
That's interesting. Australians, I guess it's their summer, so they want to come over and ski.
Yeah.
Do you see any other trends that are happening? Be interesting.
Those are the key trends. I think it's just so important to us that we build a sustainable tourism economy. We're in this for the long haul. Our natural places are in it for the long haul. We are just very focused on doing it right rather than focusing on volume.
I guess there are some natural economic trends. For example, nowadays, a lot of people don't book hotels, they book the Airbnbs.
Yes, and that has definitely influenced. There are positive things that come from the world of Airbnb. One is that all of our Airbnb hosts are paying their taxes. That's not the same for VRBO and others. So Airbnb is putting a lot of money into the Utah economy. Second positive thing is that it enables small communities that are just building out their tourism economies to provide a place for visitors to stay. The challenge with these overnight rentals is that it encroaches on the housing that's available for other types of workers. So we have a serious problem in the state for affordable housing, and the Airbnb and other overnight rentals play into that equation.
What information do you give? What suggestions do you give for a community that's just trying to build out their tourism business?
We have a whole destination development team that helps them figure out what their differentiating offerings are, how they can build out their brand, how they can develop tourism offerings. It's a really important part of what we're doing. We're working in the Carbon Emery area on destination development because they're so close to the Wasatch Front and they have so many natural wonders all around and they've never had robust tourism economies. So we're pretty excited about building that out. In the Cache County area, one of the really exciting initiatives that we've launched over the last several years is called the Yellowstone Loop. And the premise is that many international visitors are flying into the Salt Lake Airport and then driving north to Yellowstone. And so we've actually partnered with other states to slow those visitors down so that they spend money in northern Utah before they go to Yellowstone. It works well for everyone because we're adding to the richness of the visitor's experience, and we're getting tourism spending in places like Logan and Brigham City, Bear Lake, that really wanted to expand their tourism economies.
Well, very good. We've been talking with Vicki Varela, Managing Director of Utah Office of Tourism. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah on Utah Public Radio. UPR is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and UPR.org.